I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media, we will continue our community conversation about public health issues. Today, we're going to talk about rising prescription drug costs. My guests are healthcare reporter Bob Herman, Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine, and Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our community conversation in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about important public health issues. Specifically today, we're going to be talking about rising prescription drug costs. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Bob Herman. He is a healthcare reporter for Axios, Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International, and Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. So, and I probably ought to do my standard disclosure disclaimer here, even though it has been a number of years ago, Fran and I have a piece of our past in common. We both were executive directors of what then was the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, is now the ACLU of Indiana. I always err on the side of giving people all the information and not withholding some. So anyhow, with that out of the way, I would like to start the conversation. I'll start with Bob on this. I think it's helpful to talk about sort of the scope of this and who is being affected, what people are being affected the most. Could you give me an overview, and then I'll ask Fran and Elizabeth to chime in.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Certainly.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
With
prescription drug pricing today, obviously it affects consumers, those who actually need a prescription. Obviously, there's tons of different illnesses out there, and so it varies from person to person. But everyone relies on certain drugs from a wide array of pharmaceutical companies. And so those drug companies develop or research these drugs, sometimes in conjunction with the federal government. And then they will go ahead and set prices for the drugs. And then there various middlemen in the industry, either health insurers or entities as pharmacy benefit managers, they kind of negotiate over those prices. And in return, they kind of help determine which patients and which drugs are available for access. And then ultimately it gets back to the pharmacy and the consumer of what is ultimately access and how much is paid. And that amount of money that we as a country spend on prescription drugs has gone up quite a bit over time. Just recently in 2017, we as a country spent roughly, I'm looking at the numbers right now, roughly $340 billion in the country. So it's a lot of money. It's roughly 10% of the healthcare economy in total, but that's steadily gone up as more drugs hit the market and as prices go up.
Fran.
Yeah, I would just echo what Bob says about the sheer dollars involved, but I also want to emphasize that for your listeners and probably for any of us, we all know people who struggle to pay for their medicines. Globally, there's 10 million people a year by UN estimates who die, not because there's not medicines to treat them, but because they cannot afford medicines to treat them. But this isn't a problem for just a developing or a poor country. Right here in Indianapolis, right here in our own communities, we all probably know people who struggle to afford their blood pressure medicines, struggle to afford their asthma inhalers, struggle to afford their insulin costs, which I know Elizabeth will speak to more directly. One out of every five people in this country cannot afford their medicines, so they skip doses, they don't fill prescriptions, and as a result, they really jeopardize their health, and some actually suffer greatly, and some even die. That's one side of the equation. The other side, as Bob started to allude to, is the pharmaceutical industry, which is these companies are, by some measures, the most profitable in companies in modern capitalist history, making a product that people are struggling and dying because they can't afford.
Elizabeth.
Yes, I agree. The issue is global in scale. I run an organization called T1 International, and we focus specifically on type 1 diabetes and access to insulin, which is becoming, well, it has become over the past few years, such a huge issue in the U.S. in particular. People are paying hundreds of dollars for a single vial of insulin, which can cover someone for maybe a month. So when you have to buy many of these vials every year, that's adding up to a huge portion of your annual income. And my organization has done surveys across the globe to look at the costs that people have to pay. And for drugs and insulin in particular, people are paying way too much of their annual income. And we're seeing in the U.S. that in actual dollar amounts, Americans are paying far and away more than anyone else for their insulin. And we feel that, you know, that's down to the pharmaceutical companies who set the price ultimately. But to kind of look at it on a human level, I'm a patient living with type 1 diabetes myself, and I couldn't afford to live in the U.S. I actually live in the U.K. where my organization is based, but the costs for my insulin and supplies would just not be viable. I couldn't live in the States if I wanted to, and I know many, many people. I hear stories every day of people who are rationing their insulin. They're having to kind of use the black market Facebook groups to purchase insulin from people that they don't know. They're having to choose between rent and food. And this is, again, it's happening with many drugs, but insulin is what I work with directly. And there is such a huge percentage of people that are forced to pay the list price. And that's just far, far too much.
If you are just joining us, we're talking today about rising prescription drug costs here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Elizabeth, I want to, you said that you, as people in the United States, are paying far more than folks in other parts of the world. Could you put that in some kind of context? How much more? You know, what are the forces or factors producing that effect?
Sure. So in places like Canada and Mexico, people are paying maybe $10, $20 a vial. And then in other countries, particularly in places in Africa, it may be less than that. When you compare that with average monthly income, again, it's still significant for some people in some parts of the world. But as we've seen with many drugs, the system in the U.S. is very broken. It's very opaque. And it looks like these companies are charging whatever the market will bear. And when you're looking at 10 or 20 for a vial versus 200 or 300 for a vial, something is really, really wrong there.
Bob, is the United States sort of the outlier here, or are other countries having to deal with this?
Yeah, I definitely think that the United States is kind of an outlier here. Other countries like Britain, you know, others within the EU, they do have lists where they say, okay, we will not pay more than X for certain drugs. And in the United States, that doesn't really exist. And so you kind of get the system in the United States where we award both patents and certain periods of market exclusivity, where drug companies can really have free rein to charge whatever they want. And that's kind of what you're seeing now. I mean, it, like Elizabeth said, it's you see it in insulin, You see it in hepatitis C drugs. You see it in even more common drugs like heart disease, rheumatoid arthritis. Drug companies really kind of have, they're behind the wheel and they can kind of dictate how much they want to charge. And that's because there's no real system in the United States that looks into whether we as a society want to limit how much we pay for those drugs. And that's something that the industry also very much vehemently opposes.
Has this problem accelerated? Because eventually we're going to have to talk about the way healthcare works in this country as part of that discussion. But I want to save that for a bit. You'd mentioned that we spent, I think, $340 billion on prescription drugs in 2017. Could you put in some kind of context where that has gone, if possible, in constant dollars from, say, 2006 to 2017 or 2007? We'll make it a 10-year period. Is it on the upswing or has it been contained in any way?
Sure. In real dollars and in absolute dollars, it's definitely gone up. And the reason is, as more drugs, new drugs come to market, they're obviously getting very high launch prices. So it's been on the upswing for a while, and it's a trade-off, right? So if we want new medicines out there, at least from the industry's perspective, we have to be willing to pay for them. But you do see in other countries where they are willing to make trade-offs, where if it's a new drug and it doesn't really provide any true meaningful benefit, they might say, we might not pay for that. So you're really seeing a big increase in what we as a country are paying for drugs, because there are higher list prices and there really aren't too many restrictions on what we pay for. And really a lot of that money is going toward brand name drugs. And brand name drugs are the ones that drug manufacturers, they hold patents and exclusivity on. But most of what Americans get, most of what they get at the pharmacy counter is generics. So really a lot of the spending is focused on these very expensive brand name drugs that really don't have any other competitors.
Fran, the argument I'm sure that the pharmaceutical companies would advance is, we have often tremendous R&D costs that we have to sink into developing these drugs, and for every one that we are able to develop that is successful, there are many others that aren't, and we still have to absorb those costs. But the one that is successful has to bear the cost of that those research and development expenses as well. How do we deal with that question of encouraging them, the companies, to continue developing the drugs and presumably making a profit, but also containing costs?
Well, you'd start with the premise, of course, that we all need and want there to be very vigorous research and development of new drugs. The problem is the current system doesn't do that effectively, and doesn't do that effectively certainly when you add in the idea of trying to control prices. As Bob said, the patent monopolies are what drives the prices up. Our system can be described best as government taxpayer funding of the early stage research and development. We're paying for that already, we the people. 210 of the 210 most recent drugs developed, they were approved from 2010, 2016, all trace their origins back to government funding. Government's the biggest purchaser on the back end. We are giving private for-profit companies monopolies in the middle, and they're acting like private for-profit companies with monopolies will, and they're jacking the price up, as Bob said, and just charging whatever the market will bear. We can, and there's lots of evidence and lots of examples of that, we can do this research and development with public funding, with nonprofit funding, by getting away from using medicines as something to fund a corporation, not just to make some kind of profit, but to make historically high profits. We really have a flaw right in the middle of our system. Again, it kind of speaks to your point of the broader healthcare system, where we are allowing, and again, we the people have allowed that, we're handing over patent monopolies and allowing for-profit companies to hold people who are sick hostage to whatever price they can charge. And as a result, that's an awfully good business model for them, and it's a really bad health model for the rest of us.
Fran, I'm going to ask real quickly, and we're getting close on time. We're coming up on a break. Is it a problem? Most of the drugs we've talked about so far are ones where you're dealing with, life-threatening or at least serious. Is Are those, is this problem confined to those, or are we talking about things that that are somewhat less serious in nature?
It's really, as Bob said, the question is rather whether drugs are protected by patents or protected by an oligopoly, which is the situation with insulin. If there's competition, if it's generic, it's cheap. It doesn't matter what kind of drug it is. If there's not a competition, there's a monopoly, the price gets really, really high. That's the distinction.
If you're just joining us, we are talking today about rising prescription drug costs on No Limits. This is part of our partnership with Side Effects Public Media and our ongoing community conversation about public health issues. My guests are Bob Herman, Axios healthcare reporter, Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine, and Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about rising prescription drug costs. This is part of our partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media and our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues. I should emphasize that that Side Effects also is working on a podcast that will be coming later in August called The Workaround that is going to deal with a lot of these same questions. And the first episode is specifically going to be about diabetics who either ration or skip their insulin injections to save money. So it will be right on point. My guests today are Bob Herman, Axios healthcare reporter, Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine, and Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ben has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ben writes, could your guests offer any insight on the mobile app GoodRx? I once was prescribed a common drug, but the reason for my prescription fell under family planning, which insurers do not cover in Indiana. When I picked up my prescription at the pharmacy counter, I paid the full price, $110 out of pocket for a one-month supply. Later that very same day, I saw an ad for GoodRx and gave it a try. Next month, I refilled my prescription for $24, no questions asked. I would be remiss if I didn't share my story because I found the app so absolutely helpful, but I also have absolutely no idea how it works. Do your guests know? Bob, I'll start with you on that one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've spoken with one of the co-founders of GoodRx before, and essentially, it's just it's a way for people who sometimes have insurance or those who don't to kind of look. It's like almost like an Expedia. It allows you to look at different pharmacies and see how much you can get your drugs. So you can see what prices you can get, what discounts there are, the coupons that you can get, and then it provides you with kind of the lowest options, and they kind of get data from a whole bunch of sources to create these prices and discounts for people. But the end goal is to, you know, for people who both have insurance and those who don't, to find where can I get the best deal on my pharmacy cost.
We are talking about rising prescription drug costs today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Robert has done, and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Robert, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick breakdown of what it costs for the Parkinson's medication, carbidopa, levodopa. In the pill form, I'm paying $180 on Medicaid alone a month.
Mm-hmm.
But there's patch form, it's uninsured prices, $800 a month. On Medicaid, it's down to $200 a month. I could hardly afford that, so I haven't been on it yet. But with the extra help program I just got on, I'll be able to bring it down to $40 a month. That's all I need to say about ridiculously priced for relative newness.
Are you in a position, and please, if my question is intrusive, please tell me that, but that's an awful lot of money to be throwing at maintaining your health. Are there sacrifices or choices that affect other parts of your life that you have to make to pay for that medicine?
In general, the roller coaster ride of being able to get out of bed, talk clearly, and make it to the bathroom in general is what I sacrifice for being on the pill. But I have to take a pill every 3 hours or so. I have to sacrifice on sleep also.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. I appreciate it, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Fran, how common are stories like that?
Well, John, they're disturbingly common even here in the relatively wealthy U.S. here in Indiana. And I think I mentioned before that one out of every five of us are skipping doses, are not filling prescriptions, are cutting pills in half because we can't afford the medicines. And that's just here. And those stories, as we just heard, can get incredibly challenging and tragic on an individual level. There are folks in this community and doing this work that I've talked to who max out their credit cards routinely in order to pay for part of their prescription, can't afford the entire prescription. There's a gentleman we work with in our advocacy who could not afford his blood pressure medicines. He was working full-time, couldn't afford his blood pressure medicines, and he ended up with a disabling stroke that has left him permanently disabled. Both Elizabeth and I have worked with a terrific woman out of the Minneapolis area who has become a real advocate for insulin affordability because her son last year aged off his mom's health insurance, Alec Rayshon Smith, and had to ration his insulin. He was working full-time, just didn't have good insurance, and the insulin prices have gone up 1,000+% since the late 90s. Couldn't afford his insulin and was rationing it, and unfortunately, at age 26, passed away.
Elizabeth, how much of this, Fran says it's gone up more than 1,000%. What forces have produced, That's a tremendous inflationary rate. Is there anything besides, avarice on the part of the pharmaceutical companies that have produced these increases in costs?
No, I mean, as Fran said, this is the way that the system has been set up to benefit these companies. There isn't appropriate legislation demanding transparency and affordable drug costs. I think the examples, particularly of the person with the question about not really understanding how GoodRx works, so many people do not understand the system, and that is how the companies get away with charging whatever price they want to continue to have billions and billions in profits. So I really do feel that, yes, we've let it get to this point, and there needs to be more transparency because, exactly as Fran said, it's 1,123% increase in the cost of Humalog insulin, which is Eli Lilly's insulin, since June of 1996, and inflation during that time was 56%. So it's far and away beyond appropriate price increases. We know that they're profit-driven companies, but they're putting people's lives over profit.
Elizabeth, I'm going to stay with you for a second. And can we talk? I mean, one of the things, and I want to lead this into a conversation about really how our healthcare system in the United States is structured. One of the eye-openers, particularly since, when the Affordable Care Act came online, one of the primary objections to it was that it was going to, there were worries that you weren't going to be able to have your own doctor tending to your care. That was one of the major talking points. I apologize to my listeners. Normally, I try not to make this show about me, but about the subject. But in this case, I can't tell the story without including some personal history. I also am diabetic. I'm type 2. And what it's been an educational experience for me because my doctor prescribed when I was first diagnosed and decided I needed insulin, one type of insulin. I trotted over to the pharmacy and found out that my health insurance provider would not would not pay for that type of insulin, but instead recommended another. And by the way, that followed all the way through. They didn't like the glucometer I was using or any of the other things. So we had this back and forth. You know, in my case, it's not a tragedy because obviously I have health insurance. I have a good job and all of that and am used to dealing and talking with people. But there are a lot of folks in this country who, you know, don't have those resources and frankly don't have that comfort level even dealing with people they see in positions of authority. Are there ways we could streamline this system and make it much more accessible for people regardless of the demographic?
Yes, as I mentioned, I live in the UK currently, and having grown up in the US and dealt with insurers and costs and basically the nightmare of trying to get access to my essential insulin and supplies, transitioning to the UK and going to the pharmacy for the first time and realizing that I'm benefiting from the national healthcare system where, you know, I'm a tax-paying person, but I don't have to have a copay. I don't have to battle with insurance companies. The national healthcare system means that it appreciates that I have a condition, that I have essential medicine that I need to take, and I am provided those things, and the complexity and the opacity is completely taken out. The national healthcare system can negotiate prices for drugs. It doesn't always work out perfectly, but it has kept insulin prices relatively stable next to inflation here in the UK. So I certainly am very much in support of a system much more like the UK and a lot of Europe, where we're seeing, again, there are times when it doesn't work perfectly, but we're seeing on the whole, you know, no one's struggling to afford their insulin. We're not having rationing. We're not seeing people taking pet insulin in order to survive. So that's just a very, very clear example, and I'm living proof that there is a much better way.
We've gotten an email from a listener, and again, if you want to join this conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. This listener writes, please address the reality that companies that make generic drugs seem to agree on which company will make which drug. This ends up with few or only one so-called generic drug maker basically having a monopoly on it. I switch from a brand name med to a generic, and the price is only marginally less than the brand name one. This has happened to me with more than one medication. The old system of just going to a generic instead of the branded drug is long gone, at least in my world. Thank you. Is that a common phenomenon, Bob?
It definitely depends on you know, the drug. Generic drug makers have been raising their prices as well, but not in the same way that brand name drug makers do. There have been instances where you know, there's been a generic drug for it's been around for a long time, a very notable case of this was Martin Shkreli and his drug Daraprim. You know, it was generic. It was it treated you know, a parasitic infection. It essentially had a monopoly, and so even though it was generic, it could charge whatever it wanted. So there are instances out there of bad actors, even with generics, kind of taking advantage of the market conditions to kind of charge whatever they want. But again, most of the spending in the U.S. at least is on brand drugs.
Fran, are there avenues through which consumers? Because it sounds like, I mean, that sounds like something that would have happened out of the, you know, the late 19th century, and that we passed antitrust legislation to deal with, by and large. I mean, restraint of trade and all of that sort of stuff. Are there ways that people can push back?
There absolutely are. I think it's a really terrific time to have this conversation, because in doing this work and talking to folks about drug pricing, you find out that this is not a partisan issue. You have Republicans, Democrats, people from different faith backgrounds, people from the countryside, from the city, all agreeing that this is out of control? You have the president of the United States saying drug companies are, quote unquote, getting away with murder. But you also have others, frankly, more serious Republicans who are supporting legislation to try to rein in what is, you know, really, again, a monopoly problem. This is not the way that we have treated medicines historically. We've treated medicines historically as something you can't corner the market on. You can't. It's not like a smartphone or a big screen TV. This is necessary for people to live. And when the government is already so involved, frankly, our taxpayer dollars are so involved at the front end doing the research, on the back end paying for this medicines in bulk, you know, we have a lot of ability in the middle to no longer hand over monopolies in order to allow these prices to be set so high. So there's a lot of legislation pending that, again, bipartisan legislation at the national level, but states, Nevada, California, Maryland, and others have taken steps to actually try to encourage or try to demand what Elizabeth already said. Let's get some transparency to the process. Let's actually understand what's happening, how much profits are being made on each vial of insulin, which apparently only cost a few dollars to manufacture. It's being priced nearly $300. Let's get some of that information, and then we know how to fix it.
Can that be done, though, at the state level? I mean, part of the, you know, Theodore Roosevelt's argument for antitrust, supporting antitrust legislation, as you said, the federal government is the only entity big enough with big business like this to serve as an honest broker. Are states large enough, state governments large enough to do that? Start with Fran, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts on that.
Sure. I think that states are actually impactful enough to carry it, to pull it off. But this is a question in litigation right now. Maryland's drug pricing legislation is being challenged in federal court. And the question to challenge really boils down to, this should be a federal government solution. I think on a real politic level, on an organizing advocacy level, these state initiatives are really powerful because that's connected to people who are struggling to pay for their insulin, struggling to pay for their asthma meds, et cetera. And they know their state representatives, they know their local officials, and they're pushing. And frankly, the end result, probably the big picture solution, is going to be a federal solution. But these state initiatives are helping drive some of the organizing, drive some of the advocacy, and frankly, giving folks like our caller some hope that we can have a better system than this, because we absolutely can have a better system than this.
Elizabeth, your thoughts?
Very much in agreement with what Fran said. We're seeing people who are affected by this starting to speak out and get in touch with the representatives for the first time ever, which, again, when it's you know, a difficult time for people, when they're struggling, but they still can see that hope and realize that it's worthwhile to share their personal story, to help other people realize that they're not alone in this struggle, and that, you know, people power really does matter on a state level and on the federal level. We're very much about the approach of one step at a time, and people taking the first step is huge, and this is going to be a long game till we get the kind of change that we want to see, but it's a game that's, you know, life or death, so we have to keep playing.
Bob.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go agree with both Fran and Elizabeth. I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find a federal lawmaker who is not affected by or hearing about high drug costs for their constituents. But I think any kind of change probably will start on the state level. Federal level, you're talking about Medicare negotiating for drug prices, and that's just overwhelmingly opposed by everyone in the industry. And this goes to something even bigger. Obviously, drug companies, they set the list prices. They're not going to be in favor of any kind of federal solution that involves Medicare negotiating. But there's other people and other companies in the drug supply chain that wouldn't want that too. I've reported on pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs. They're this middleman that a lot of people may not be aware of. They're probably not going to be in favor of that either, because it will affect their bottom line as well. And PBMs essentially are, we've documented instances where they kind of play games with, you know, the drugs that people pay, and probably contribute a little bit to the prices that we pay. So if we're thinking about a federal solution, there's opposition, not just from drug companies, but from many other people in the chain as well.
We are talking about rising prescription drug costs today on No Limits. My guests are Bob Herman, Axios healthcare reporter, Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine, and Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're continuing our community conversation in partnership with our colleagues at SideEffects Public Media about important public health issues. Today, specifically, we're talking about rising prescription drug costs. It's a subject, obviously, that SideEffects is going to continue, and in fact, it's going to be feature of a podcast that's going to be rolling out in August next month, in which they talk about the lengths to which people are going to try to overcome obstacles in getting the medicines they need, specifically insulin, which we have talked about. And the podcast is called The Workaround. My guests are Bob Herman, Axios healthcare reporter, Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine, and Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Sandy has done, reach out to us via Twitter. You can find us at WFYI. Sandy makes a comment, Bob, that was picking up on your point right before we went to the break. She says, please discuss how the pharmacy benefit managers are pushing back on coupon programs like GoodRx. Bob, I'll throw that one back to you since you brought it in into the conversation.
Sure. Happy to talk about it. So oftentimes, to help consumers pay for their drugs, drug companies will offer what's called copay coupons. So for very expensive drugs, people go to the pharmacy, and instead of paying big amounts of money out of pocket for a specific drug, they can just hand over this coupon. It could be like an online, you just scan it online, it could actually be a physical coupon, and then your drug's pretty much covered. And for, if you're the person taking that drug, it's great. It basically makes it free or very cheap for you. There are some drawbacks to that, even though you, the person, it's good for you, you don't pay as much or nothing at all. Everyone else still pays the entire cost of that drug. So there's some questions about whether copay coupons are good for society when it still kind of allows the drug maker to charge whatever they want. In response, a lot of PBMs and health insurers have been fighting back against those copay coupons because they are paying for the rest of the drug. And in response, they're instituting these programs that basically cap how much a person can use that coupon. And so right around this time of the year, we're hearing from people who are finding unpleasant surprises when they go to the drug counter and they have to pay for a lot out of pocket when they used to just use these coupons. And it's this battle between drug companies and insurance companies and middlemen who are trying to control costs, but make sure everyone still gets the drugs that they need. And I mean, in the end, it's always about money. Who's getting the money? But this is one area, the coupons in particular, that the people are starting to figure out right now, and it's starting to adversely affect them.
We have gotten, I've got a fistful of emails here that are taking us to the point that I think we have to talk about. Got emails from a listener named Cheryl, from Kenny, from Dan, who apparently is a doctor, and from Kate, and they all want to talk about the Affordable Care Act and the implications here. If I'm going to try to synthesize and make sure that each point gets hit here, to some degree, like Dan, the doctor, says the entire system is broken. 50% of all new drugs have government support during the development process. Insulin pricing is based upon the collusion of manufacturers. Also, the generic price is rigged, too. And then Cheryl says that, that the uncertainty that's been built into the system now with ACA and its future or fate has had a destabilizing effect on markets. And, you know, they wanted, Kate wants to know whether, you know, ACA was effective at controlling some of these costs. They're all approaching the question from somewhat different points, but circling around the same thing. I'll start with Elizabeth's views on this.
So in terms of whether or not the Affordable Care Act has helped or hurt, I think that's one of, at least one of the points that was there. And yeah. I think, as I alluded to earlier, I think there is simply a better way. And this was an attempt at a solution to make things better. And I think many, many more people were covered under insurance. When a lot of these drug pricing discussions happen, I feel that often the most vulnerable are forgotten or left out of these discussions. Even talking about things like which insulin will be covered or which medication will be covered, or if you're can see the doctor that you want to see. People without insurance don't get to think about these kinds of specifics. They're trying to get by day to day. They're not able to afford a doctor. They're maybe trying to find the best way to get by and find their medication. So I think my opinion in brief, because I know there's not a lot of time here, is that it certainly was to the benefit of many, and it helped to ensure that people could get covered and thus afford their medicine to a greater degree. But obviously there's a lot of issues, and I can only reiterate that the whole system is broken, and we need to hold everybody along the supply chain, between the pharmaceutical companies who make and set the prices, all the way to, you know, everybody in between when we actually pick up our medications. They all need transparency and to be held accountable, and hopefully continued advocacy and people getting informed will lead to that.
Bob, how much of this, when we say the system is broken, is a product really of the uncertainty right now? I mean, this president and this Congress, they came in arguing with the ACA that they were going to repeal and replace. And instead, kind of what happened is that they sort of repealed, didn't do much to replace, and everybody's kind of waiting to see what's going to happen next. And that seems to have had, you know, a fairly destabilizing effect on the whole process.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the ACA, I do think it is worth remembering that the ACA, for most of the ACA, is still around. The only thing that really got changed was the individual mandate to purchase insurance. That was basically nullified, more or less. And the ACA in general, and Elizabeth alluded to this, it definitely helps broaden access for people to get their drugs. If you don't have insurance through your job, or maybe Medicaid got expanded in your state, suddenly you had access to drugs that maybe you didn't before. But the ACA overall was about broadening access. It was not about, or did very little to control healthcare costs. And with the uncertainty around the ACA, certainly makes reforming the drug system more difficult. But Casey in total really didn't do a whole lot in terms of how much we as a society pay for drugs and hospital services. But there's certainly more to be done, but the uncertainty, it doesn't help.
Fran.
Well, I completely agree that the Affordable Care Act has much, much room for improvement. But for any of us who live in a state, as Bob alluded to, it's expanded Medicaid in Indiana. We have 400,000 plus people on the Healthy Indiana Plan who, we all frankly probably know people in our circles or our families, or in our case, in our clients of our health and human rights clinic at IU McKinney Law School. So you know people, you have to fight and defend what's there now, right? Mm-hmm. But the actual flaw in the Affordable Care Act is the flaw in our system. And Bob alluded to it before when he said that there are many people in the chain who are objecting to Medicare negotiation. And in reality, I appreciate him saying that. But those people are not people. They're not us. 92% of the people, Republicans, Democrats, support Medicare negotiation. People support getting the costs down. People support getting the profits out. What we have done in the Affordable Care Act is continue to enshrine the flaw in our system, which is we put the most vulnerable, sick people in the hands of companies that are going to profit maximize. And those companies spend their dollars on lobbying, spend their dollars on campaign contributions, and they fight to keep this system as flawed as it is, because it's flawed for most of us, but it is making a lot of money for a few. And that really, when it comes down to the idea that we treat medicines, that we treat health as a tool for price gouging, that's the fundamental flaw that we do need to address. And you asked the question before about the bigger picture of the health system. It's the problem with medicines. It's the problem with our health system that we have turned over incredibly important roles to entities who are focused not on our health, but are focused on shareholder interests and focused on quarterly profit margins.
So, Fran, I'm going to stay with you, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts on this. By most estimates, healthcare accounts for about 20% of the U.S. economy. I mean, it is a huge slice with massive amounts of money flowing through it. How realistic is it that we're going to be able to affect meaningful change there to contain those costs when, there may be whales that are somewhat larger in the world, but not many.
Right. Well, I think that Elizabeth spoke to it very well, that the more that we are aware that it doesn't have to be this way, that folks in the UK, folks in Canada, folks in Japan, folks in essentially every other industrialized, wealthy nation are paying less for their health care and getting better health care than the rest of us. We are going to need to find ways to replace some of the employment of people who are claims adjusters and for-profit insurance companies. We need to find some ways to replace, some of the incredible inefficiencies in the pharmaceutical industry, et cetera. But that's a challenge I think that we have to take on, because for every single one of us, we are adversely affected in our pocketbook or oftentimes in our own health with how incredibly dysfunctional and backward our current system is.
Elizabeth, let me ask you, since you are living in the UK and accessing that healthcare system, at least part of the mythology here in the United States is that Brits and Canadians are completely disgusted with their healthcare system, that they can't get the kind of quality healthcare that they want or access the services they want. Is there truth to that mythology, or what is the way people in the UK think of their healthcare?
Yeah, I think it's very, very much a myth. I think it's perpetuated by people that want to keep the system the way that it is in the US. I may end up waiting an extra half an hour at times, or in worst case scenarios, I wait an extra hour in non-urgent situations. And to me, that is worth the thousands and thousands that I save that I would have to pay in the U.S. And I just it always is astounding to me that this myth is perpetuated in the way that it is, because everyone that I know in the U.K. dearly loves the NHS and is doing their best to preserve it and trying to prevent it from going towards a very privatized system more like the U.S. So all I can say is, yes, it is a myth. There's some very tiny kernels and nuggets that I believe that these things started from. But having lived in both systems, it's far and away, there's no contest. I would choose this system anytime, and I think most people who had the chance to experience both would say the same.
Bob, I'm going to pose the same question to you that I posed to Fran. With this being 20% of the U.S. economy, how likely is it that we would get meaningful reform? There are an awful lot of people invested, powerful people invested in the current system.
Right. And Jen, I think you're asking the right question. Healthcare it has been a big part of the U.S. economy for a long time now, and it's really hard to understate just how powerful and entrenched some of these companies are. And this goes beyond just pharmaceutical companies, such as health insurance, medical device, even hospitals and doctors. There's an industry here that is far larger than I think most people realize. So to enact meaningful change means to overhaul the incomes of a very big portion of people in the industry. And that's obviously something that they're going to fight tooth and nail for as long as they can. But to Elizabeth and Fran's point, you know, I talk to people too, and people are really pissed about the healthcare system right now, be it drugs or just being unable to afford their hospital bill. People are very upset, and it certainly seems like we're continuing to get more to a tipping point where if there's not whole scale change, you know, something's going to happen. There almost has to be, because this also affects other portions of the economy. If we as a country are spending more on healthcare, that means less money for education or infrastructure, what have you. It'll be hard just because the healthcare industry itself is one of the biggest and one of the most powerful when it comes to lobbying and spending. But the general public, the vast majority of it, is pretty fed up with the system.
Bob, I'm going to stay with you for a second, but I want everyone to answer this question. I don't want to leave people without hope here, and we've only got a couple of minutes before we come to the end of the program. If you are, you know, being forced to make difficult choices in terms of getting the medicines that you need, what are some places you can call or reach out to for help? I'll start with Bob, but I'm going to take it around the horn.
Sure. Shopping is a little bit limited in the U.S. healthcare system, but using programs like GoodRx or even being inquisitive with your doctor. If a doctor prescribes you a drug, ask him or her how much it costs, how much it will cost you. Do you recommend any other places to get it? And then even going to there's plenty of charities and advocacy groups out there. Like the people on this show, who their sole purpose is to help people who are in need. So even though it might seem like you're drowning in your drug costs or whatever your medical bill might be, there are groups and even your doctor. Your doctor is supposed to be an advocate for you as well.
Elizabeth, you got about 30 seconds.
Yep. So in addition to all of those things, I would just say, if you're able to become an advocate for yourself and for others, join organizations like TUIN International, People of Faith for Access to Medicines, and others. Make sure that you're taken care of first, but stand up and speak so that we can have change, so that you're not having to pay hundreds for your drugs.
Fran, you get the last word, but that's the good news. The bad news is you got about 25 seconds to deliver.
Well, I could just say ditto to what Elizabeth said, but I do think history shows that as much as the challenge is there, and you're exactly right to say there's a lot of financial powerful issues pushing to keep the system the way it is, people, patient-led advocacy, people of faith, folks in the community reaching out to their lawmakers and saying, your job is on the line if we aren't able to afford our medicines and health care, that's going to win.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Bob Herman, Axios healthcare reporter, Fran Quigley, coordinator of People of Faith for Access to Medicine, and Elizabeth Rowley of T1 International for a lively conversation. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.